for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Federal spending is up, and federal tax revenues are not keeping pace. Nearly half of all citizens pay no federal tax at all. The nation's wealthy have picked up an ever larger share of the tab, but they've also enjoyed record-breaking pre-tax pay increases. Joining me to talk about who's filling federal tax revenue coffers and how tax policy could shift, Robertson Williams. He's with the Tax Policy Center. David Leonhardt, he's a columnist for the New York Times, joining us by phone from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Joel Slemrod, he's professor of economics at the University of Michigan. I'm sure many of you are interested in who's paying taxes, who's not, and why. Feel free to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. Joel Slemrod, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
And David Leonhardt, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Bob Williams, I'll start with you. Tell us who's paying taxes and who's not.
Well, first of all, by our estimates, about 47% of Americans will not pay any federal income tax this year, the income tax returns that we're all filing by this Thursday. The reason behind that is that the government has been using the tax system for two different purposes. One purpose is to raise revenues, and the other is to carry out some social policies through a whole range of tax credits, deductions, and exclusions that reduce the liability, tax liability, for many Americans, 47% of them, to zero. Who is paying the tax? It's the wealthy, those single individuals who don't have dependents, those people without much in the way of deductions, or those people subject to the alternate minimum tax. Who is exempt from tax? Mostly low-income households, families with children, families with large deductions, or who can take benefits, who can benefit from the multitude of credits that we now have in the tax system.
How did we get here, David Leonhardt?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that there are two things going on, and when you combine them, it muddies the picture. The first thing going on is that we've had soaring incomes at the top of the distribution. So if we look at the cutoff to be in the top 0.01%, so that's the top, 1/10,000th of earners, that has gone in inflation-adjusted dollars from $1.8 million in 1979 to $8.6 million in 2005, the last year that the government has put out numbers on that. That's just a huge increase. For most people over that time, there's been only slow income growth. So at the top, we've had really, really rapid income growth. At the same time, the tax rates for those folks have been falling, and they've actually been falling more rapidly than they have for any other groups. If you look at the total effective tax rate, which not only federal tax rate, which not only includes income taxes, but payroll taxes, the tax rate for that group at the top has fallen from 43% in 1979 to 32% in 2005, a much bigger decline than for any other group. When you put the two together, though, rising income and falling tax rate, the rise in income has been big enough that the share of taxes that group has been paying has been rising, even though their tax rate has been falling. So on any individual dollar they earn, they are paying less in taxes, but they are earning so many more dollars that their share of total taxes paid has gone up. And that's why, as Bob was just talking about, the share of taxes we have that's being paid by the very rich has risen over time.
So you come to the question, Joel Slemrod, how fair is the system as it currently stands?
Well, to ask an economist about fairness is really to push us a little bit beyond our expertise. I think most Americans agree that the tax burden should be progressive, meaning that higher income people should pay as taxes a higher percentage of their income. We certainly have that with our tax system overall, if not in particular parts. In fact, if you ask people about whether the tax system is fair as it is, a majority of people will say that they think high-income people should pay more, and they don't pay their fair share now. That public perception, I think, will be tested now that we've had increases on high-income people through the health care bill and in the budget proposal for further increases in the top rate for high-income people. So the direction, in the short run at least, is to move where most people seem to want it to go, that is to have higher-income people pay higher rates than they do now.
Joel Slemrod. He's professor of economics at the University of Michigan and co-author of Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Bob, you talked about the programs that have been put into place that that taxes are paying for. And what you're saying is that even as the incomes of the higher income people go up, their tax rates are not keeping pace. So who's paying for these social programs?
Now, one of the problems is we're not really paying for most of the social programs. We're running huge deficits, in part this year and last year and probably next year, because of the economic downturn, which has reduced the incomes of lots of individuals, and in part because we're trying to stimulate the economy through a whole series of special tax credits that applied in 2008 through the Bush stimulus payments of $600 per person, $1,200 per couple, $300 per child. And during the last year and this year, 2009-2010 taxes, the various provisions in the stimulus bill passed right after President Obama took office. The Making Work Pay Credit that provides $400 for each worker to $800 for each couple. An expansion of the Child Tax Credit Fundability, an expansion of the Earned Income Tax Credit, expansion of the American Opportunity Credit that provides assistance for people attending colleges, more assistance for across the board, trying to pump money into the economy at a time when we need the fiscal stimulus to get the economy going again.
And doing that by reducing taxes on people with children, reducing taxes on payments to college, that kind of thing.
Exactly. What it's doing is it's targeting aid to various groups that the president and Congress felt needed the assistance and would help stimulate the economy right now. We could do exactly the same thing through spending programs, but Congress has chosen to do it through the tax system for a couple of reasons. One, it's much more efficient to administer it through a tax system that almost all of us correspond with at least once a year. We file that little return on April 15th. But secondly, because it's a lot easier from a political perspective to cut someone's taxes than to start a new spending program. Go back for election and tell people you start a new spending program and you're not very popular. Tell them you cut their taxes, and that sounds like a pretty good thing to most Americans.
Tell me what happened, David Leonhardt, as a result of the Bush tax cuts and how they have affected the relationship between income tax and gross domestic product.
Well, for a long time, there was a very strong argument that we heard that cutting taxes was fabulous for growth and economic growth. And theoretically, this is an unassailable argument. If you cut taxes, you should give people more incentive to work, more incentive to invest. If you hold all else equal, cutting taxes should, in fact, lift economic growth. The real question is what the magnitude of the effect is, because all else isn't equal. There are tons of other things going on in the economy. Cutting taxes can also increase the deficit, which can increase interest rates and be a drag on growth. So the question is, how big is this effect? And it looks like the effect is just not nearly as as big as some people have argued. And there are economic studies that make this case. Joel can talk a little bit more about those. But in some ways, we don't even need regression analysis to make this case. We can look at the experience of the last few decades. George W. Bush cut taxes at the start of the last decade, and the promise was that this would be great for economic growth. In fact, the decade that just ended had the slowest economic growth of any decade since World War II.
Now, how do you compare that with tax cuts in past decades?
Well, so if we look at the Reagan tax cuts of 1981, those do seem to have had a positive effect on growth. Reagan cut taxes significantly in 1981. Then he raised taxes, taking back some of the tax cuts in 1982. The economy took off after the tax increase, interestingly enough. Huh. But I think it's fair to give the net tax cut some credit for growth there. But if we go back, we basically see that Bill Clinton raised taxes. There were all kinds of warnings that this was going to send the economy into a tailspin. Instead, we had the 1990s boom. Growth was much more rapid after the Clinton tax increases than it was after the Bush tax cuts.
How do you explain that?
I think the effect of taxes on growth just aren't that huge. I think they're there, but I think there are so many other things going on that this notion that somehow tax cuts are a magic bullet that's going to lead to fabulous growth, we should now really reject that argument. We've had 60 years of experience. We raised taxes enormously to pay for World War II. They remained very high after the war, and we had fabulous growth in the 1950s and 60s. And so if you look back over the last six decades, you have some evidence that tax cuts make a difference, and I think they do make a difference. But basically, you have a large amount of evidence saying that they've been oversold and that other things probably play a bigger role.
David Leonhardt, he is a columnist for the New York Times. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more, take your calls and your email. And we're back talking about income taxes, who's paying what, who's not paying. We have three guests. Joel Slemrod, he's professor of economics at the University of Michigan. He joins us by phone. Here in the studio, David Leonhardt, a columnist for the New York Times, and Robertson Williams. He's a principal research associate at the Tax Policy Center. It's a joint venture of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Here's what everybody wants to know. Who are the evaders? Joel Slemrod.
Well, it's interesting to look at the numbers that are usually thrown out to measure how progressive the tax system is. The way it works is you look at tax paid and you divide by reported income. That's the data that the government has. But if you look at what the IRS thinks is the pattern of tax noncompliance or evasion over income classes, it looks like on average there's more noncompliance in the upper income classes, for the most part because they earn the types of income that it's easier to hide. For example, in the second decile, the IRS thinks the noncompliance rate is about 4%. But if you look at the top 1%, it's closer to 20%.
Ugh.
What does that have to do with the conversation today? Well, it means that the progressivity of the income tax is somewhat overstated.
Yeah.
Because what you'd really like to do is divide tax paid by what true income is. And on average, because high-income people are understating their true income, we've been overstating their true average tax rates. So that doesn't turn around the statement that the tax system on balance is progressive, but it's somewhat less progressive than you'd think if you ignored the patterns of noncompliance that I just mentioned.
And Joel, how is it that these evaders or those who are noncompliant manage to get away with their noncompliance?
Well, the IRS is doing the best job they can. They have limited resources, nor, I think, would anyone want to give them all the resources they needed to eliminate tax noncompliance, just the way we probably wouldn't want to spend the resources to put a policeman on every corner to eliminate crime. But just by the nature of how the tax enforcement system works, if you have just wages and salaries, your employer is remitting through withholding most of what you owe and sending to the IRS your Social Security number and what income you have. So there's really not much scope if you have just wages and salaries. But for high-income people, on average, they have income from all sorts of different places, self-employment income, foreign investments, etc. And it's just harder for the IRS to keep track of those sorts of incomes. So if you have just wages and salaries and don't itemize your deductions, if you had the inclination to evade, and many people don't, but if you had that inclination, it's just not easy to do.
Here's an email from Jennifer. She's in Tallahassee, Florida. She says, I think the real problem is no one actually pays the taxes needed to support the services we have. Please ask if anyone knows how much each American would need to pay in taxes annually in order to support the current level of federal government with no deficit. David.
Well, this is a very disturbing answer. So Alan Auerbach and Bill Gale, two economists, have put out an estimate. And they say that if we want to pay not just for current spending, which really isn't the big problem, but for future spending, the Medicare promises we've made, the Social Security promises we've made, we would need to raise federal taxes permanently and immediately by 50%. So if you took everyone's taxes and raised them by 50%, that's what we need to completely close the long-term budget gap. That's obviously too big an increase. Now, there's some uncertainty there, right? Maybe things will turn out to be a little bit better than we think, and it would only need to be a 30% increase, or maybe it'll turn out to be worse, and it would need to be a 70% increase. But that, the scale of that kind of tax increase, which clearly would have a bad effect on our economy and on growth, even if you think the effects of taxes on growth have been overstated, is one of the reasons why we really need to take on this long-term spending. It's one of the reasons that health reform is so important, and while I had wished there was more to control spending and health reform, it does make some really important starts. And that's why a lot of the action here is going to be, can we over time restrain the growth of Medicare and Medicaid spending so that we don't have to face a 50% tax rate increase going forward?
But back to taxes. You've got one party in this country which has said over and over and over again that cutting taxes makes sense, that it puts more money in the individual pocket, it urges or helps people to spend more money, helps the economy. And yet the evidence apparently indicates otherwise. So how does this idea stay alive, Bob?
Well, it really does take a lot of faith to believe that every tax cut is good for the economy. Economists in general believe that a tax that has a very broad base, that covers a lot of income or a lot of purchases at a very low rate, is not a very bad thing to have. It's good to have it broad-based low rate because that doesn't affect people's behavior very much. The higher the rates go, the narrower the base, the less we tax at the higher rates, the more effect we have on people's behavior, and the worse it is for the economy. You put those two things together, and you can say, on the one hand, if we have really high rates, bringing them down could be a very good thing. Once we're down somewhat, down to relative low rates and reasonable levels, it doesn't help nearly as much. And yeah, it might be nice to have more money in your pocket, but it's also nice to have those government services that we all enjoy.
Go ahead, David.
I think there, I would distinguish between two parts of the Republican Party on taxes right now. And I acknowledge one of those two parts is bigger than the other. But there's one part of the party that is talking very loudly about we need to have more tax cuts and more tax cuts. But it accompanies that with no discussion of how to cut spending along with that, other than to say waste, fraud, and abuse and all that stuff. That's not a serious economic argument. It may work politically, right? It's basically the free lunch argument, but it's not a serious economic argument. The other part of the party actually has come out with some ideas for very specific spending cuts. Now, this is a much smaller part of the party, but it includes Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican, who is the ranking member of the party on the budget committee. And he's come out with a plan. Maybe it doesn't completely close the deficit as he claims, but it gets quite close. It would get rid of Medicare, as we now know it, for anyone under the age of 55. If you're under 55 now, you wouldn't have Medicare when you get there. You would instead get a voucher that would allow you to buy health insurance. And we can sort of have a debate about whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing. But at least there's a plan. He's basically saying, look, I don't want taxes to rise, and these are the kinds of things it's going to require to do that. Anyone who calls for tax cuts, I think what we need to say to them is, okay, great. How would you cut spending to do it? Don't tell me waste, fraud, and abuse. Tell me, are you going to cut military spending? Are you going to cut Social Security spending? Are you going to cut Medicare spending? And how are you going to do it? Because that's really what being in favor of tax cuts means.
But, Joel, what about tax increases? Is there any possibility that that is going to happen within, say, the next 4 years?
Well, if the horizon is 4 years, I think it's very unlikely to see the sorts of tax increases that, as David said, we would have to consider if we're going to keep on the promised spending path with Medicare and Social Security. The economic reality here is that the cost to the economy of what government does is measured by what it spends. It's not measured by what taxes it collects to a first order. If the government spends what it on the path it looks like it's forecast now, whether we raise that money with taxes or we don't raise it with taxes and have huge deficits, that doesn't reduce the cost to a first order. What it does is it just puts off reckoning with the cost. It puts off assigning the burden of the taxes needed to fund the spending, and that's what makes it politically attractive, because it looks like the cost of government is lower, but it really isn't lower. And I think the political rhetoric, which is largely on the Republican side, to starve the beast meaning the government, to cut taxes and hope that the fear of deficits reduces spending, is blurring this economic reality. And on the other hand, on the other side, recently we've expanded the beast by introducing a new health insurance entitlement without yet reckoning seriously over the long term with how of the cost of that by assigning the tax burden.
What about the stimulus packages? How have they affected tax receipts, Joel?
Well, the stimulus package is a big number. It's in the hundreds of billions, near a trillion. And in my view, a stimulus package was needed in early 2009 to prevent full-scale panic and collapse of the economy. There's good news and bad news here. The bad news is that these are big numbers and they add to the federal debt. The good news is the increased debt and deficits through the stimulus package is just a drop in the bucket compared to the dire long-term fiscal imbalances that David was talking about. It's really that problem that the body politic has to get a grip on, either by cutting back on the entitlements, increasing how much we tax ourselves or some combination of the two.
But what happens when the stimulus programs come to an end, Joel?
Well, we have to do a delicate balancing act. In the short run, when the economy is underperforming, tax cuts can help. Big tax increases are not a good idea. But we do need to wean ourselves from the stimulus tax cuts and other incentives, and we have to do it pretty soon. So this is the balancing act that the Treasury Department and the government is facing now. I think in a few more months, keep our fingers crossed, we'll be in recovery and we can stop thinking about tax cuts as a way to fight the recession.
But
one of the things we have to realize is that Congress has to do something this year in order to keep the Bush tax cuts from sunsetting entirely at the end of 2010. If Congress does nothing, we're going to have a very, very large tax increase across the board starting for next year.
Explain that.
When the Bush tax cuts were passed in 2001 and 2003, because of various parliamentary reasons in the Senate in particular, they limited the lifespan of the tax cuts to 10 years. That meant they lasted from 2001 through 2010. But come the stroke of midnight on December 31st of this year, almost all of the Bush tax cuts will disappear and will revert to the taxes as they were roughly in 2000.
What about the alternative minimum tax?
Now, the alternative minimum tax is another piece of the tax system that has been patched year after year by Congress to keep Americans from falling into its clutches. This year, we expect about 4 million Americans to be subject to the tax. If Congress had not patched it as part of the stimulus bill last year, estimated 27 million people would have been subject to the tax. And if Congress doesn't do anything next year, the numbers will be on that order.
Do you expect them to?
I absolutely do expect them to, but then I was one predicting last year that they would extend the estate tax, and they didn't do that.
Bob Williams of the Tax Policy Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. We'll open the phones. 800-433-8850. First to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, April. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest could explain the earned income credit that I have seen people that pay, you know, very little in income tax into the system, and yet they receive thousands of dollars back. That, to my way of reasoning, that doesn't make sense.
David.
What we've done, and Bob was talking about this before, what we've done with our social policy is we've shifted it from being more of a spending part of it, from spending to taxes. And so basically what we've said is we don't like the idea of welfare. Instead, what we like for our anti-poverty programs, we want to do it through the tax code. We want to give you an incentive to work. So we've said if you work and you make very little money, one of the ways we're going to help you is we are going to give you money, extra money for the extra time that you work. That is what the earned income tax credit is. And as a result, when you net it all out, these are people who are not paying any taxes, as the caller notes. And it's a tough call, right? I mean, this is a question of how much do we want to do to alleviate poverty? If we have people out there making $7 an hour with families who really can't get by, do we want to let them fend for themselves? I think that's one argument. And the other argument is, no, we want to go out and we want to give them encouragement to work and we want to try to have anti-poverty programs. That second idea is part and parcel of the notion that we're going to have people who aren't paying any income tax. Those people still are paying tax. They're paying payroll taxes and other taxes. They're paying sales taxes. So it's not as if they're getting off scot-free, but they're not paying any income taxes.
One thing to realize about the EITC is it was a bipartisan effort to pass the earned income tax credit and to increase it over time. It was passed in the 1970s when we had a Republican president, Gerald Ford. It was expanded under President Reagan, who said it was the best welfare program in existence. And it was further expanded under the first President Bush and under President Clinton. So it's been a popular program for both parties because it does encourage people to go to work and it does subsidize those people who are doing what we would like to see them do.
All right. To Caitlin, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air. Caitlin, let's try that again. Are you there, Caitlin?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I heard the guest say earlier that he thought there were some other factors contributing to economic growth, I was wondering what he thought those were and how you could go about measuring the impacts of some of those factors.
David.
I think it's important to say we don't completely know what causes economic growth. That's one of the reasons I'm so skeptical of the argument that tax cuts are the best policy for lifting growth. The other is that history doesn't support that. But having said that, what are some of the things that seem to lift growth? Well, investment seems to lift economic growth. The kinds of investment that both the private sector and the public sector makes. So, for example, when companies do things today in order to be able to make bigger profits tomorrow, when they build new factories, and when the government does the same thing, I think this is really important to remember. Yes, the government does some ridiculous things. We can all cite examples of government waste. But let's also think about the interstate highway system. Let's think about the internet, which the Defense Department built. Let's think about our fabulous biotechnology industry, which was supported by grants from the federal government. Those are things that our taxes paid for. Those are things that have lifted growth. And the private sector was able to make huge profits off of them after the government made those investments.
David Leonhard, he's a columnist for the New York Times. More of your calls when we come back, your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. From the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The grandson of Lord of the Rings author J.R.R. Tolkien on their close relationship. How his grandfather's celebrity and literary achievement influenced his life and his own writing career. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And we're back talking about the income tax system, but also here's an email from Chris in St. Louis, Missouri. He says the discussion is only about income tax. What has not been covered is the FICA tax, which makes a huge contribution to the federal system, as well as sales taxes, property taxes, that make the overwhelming contribution to state and local government. When these are factored in, most working Americans do pay taxes to help pay for the government they are receiving. Joel.
Well, that's absolutely right. Social Security taxes are raising about the same amount as individual income taxes now. And they're not progressive. They are a flat rate of tax up to a certain limit, putting aside the new Medicare tax instituted with the health care bill. So it is true that working Americans are bearing the burden of government through the payroll tax. It's also true that state and local governments tend to use sales taxes and property taxes, which are probably, on balance, regressive, meaning that the tax burden as a fraction of income is higher for low-income people. So the emailer is absolutely right that if you look at all taxes, not only the federal income tax, but the federal payroll tax and state and local taxes, the system is not as progressive as you would think from looking only at federal income taxes. But one more point is important. There's a big difference between the federal income tax and the federal payroll tax system, the Social Security and Medicare taxes. And that is, the Social Security tax buys you something. That is, your benefits when you retire or become disabled are tied, not exactly tied, but tied to the taxes you've paid during your working years. That, of course, is not true for the income tax. You don't get a deluxe ticket to Yellowstone if you've paid more income tax. And so the net burden of payroll taxes has to net out the fact that you're going to be getting more benefits upon retirement the more you've paid in.
But that's there's a problem there, Bob.
Well, the benefits are progressive. The return to people at the bottom end of the income distribution is greater than the return to people at the top. So it does undo some of the regressivity of the tax themselves. At the same time, low-income people are much more likely to retire early, get lower benefits because they retire before the age of full retirement, which is now 66, moving to 67. And in addition, they're very likely to live less long and therefore draw less benefits. So on whole, on balance, it's unclear what the progressivity, regressivity of the entire system is. Probably on the regressive side, Joel's looked at this more closely than I, and he can say more than I can.
But since people are living longer these days, isn't some adjustment to the Social Security system, the age of retirement, all of the benefits, when benefits are paid, doesn't some adjustment have to be made, Joel?
Yes, I think the grand compromise, the grand solution looking ahead to the fact that the promised benefits through Medicare and Social Security vastly exceed the taxes in place, I think the solution should involve a combination of tax increases and a scaling back of the benefits that have been promised. I think a natural part of that solution would be to gradually increase the age at which full benefits can be claimed. When the Social Security system began in the 30s, no one could have possibly envisioned how many years in retirement that the average person now gets, and so therefore the number of years that the Social Security system and now the Medicare system has to pay out. And so I do agree that looking ahead to solving this fiscal imbalance, that should be part of the solution.
David.
I'm going to betray a little bit of generational bias here, but I think one thing that's important to do is also to not to say that we're going to put the whole burden of paying for our deficit on people who are, say, younger than 55. A lot of the proposals that you hear out there say, well, let's leave things constant for anyone who's on Social Security or Medicare now and anyone who's going to be on it soon. And I don't think we should make radical changes because people have made life plans based on that and they can't adjust. But having said that, people who are 55 and 65 have not paid enough in taxes over their lifetime, on average, to cover the cost of the benefits they are now promised. And the idea that we're going to take that whole deficit and shift it to everyone who's 50 and 40 and 30 and not yet born today strikes me as unfair. And one of the things that we need to do, in addition to raising the retirement age, is looking at things like inflation adjustments and not say the whole burden of paying for this is going to be left to people who were born after the baby boomers.
All right, to Jerry in Chepachet, Rhode Island. Good morning. You're on the air.
I'm 44, and so I'm so glad to hear somebody talk about that. And everyone in my generation, we feel like we're not going to get any Social Security. There's not going to be anything left by the time the baby boomers go through. But a lot of us feel that it just needs to be, you know, more need-based. If you're a wealthy older person, you know, you can't be getting, you know, we don't want old people to not get health care and not be fed. But for the rich, wealthier older people, they need to be paying for this deficit and not just leave it for our generation who's, you know, there's no way we'll be able to do that. But the reason for my call was actually having to do more with the taxing we were talking about before.
Yes.
Tax cuts. I have a number of friends at different income brackets, and we were talking a lot about this in the last year, and they all finally had to agree with me. My friends that are at the top income bracket make, you know, some serious money. If they got a tax break, they wouldn't spend the money. They have enough money to buy whatever they want right now. And what they would do is invest it, whether it's in gold or the stock market or some kind of oil futures, something. The people in the middle, like myself, we would pretty much pay down our credit cards and different, you know, debt that we have right now. We wouldn't necessarily go out and spend too much either. And it's only my friends at the lower end of the income bracket who, if they got a tax break, would definitely like go out and spend it, because right now they're not able to buy things that they need anyway. So I think that's when you look at tax cuts and saying, oh, the Republicans say it's got to be across the board, you know, to be stimulative. I think it's actually only the low-end tax cuts that are stimulative. My friends at the top end of the income bracket, they're going to go invest it in China or oil futures or wherever they think they're going to get the top end. A lot of them, too, they're in positions where they would be hiring people.
I've lost my trail of thought. Let me address your first comment about means testing Social Security. We already do that to some degree, because some of Social Security is taxed if you're a higher income recipient. People at the bottom end of the distribution have none of their benefits taxed, but people at the top of the income distribution have as much as 85% taxed.
Now, on the question of what lower income people versus...
The second question is actually something that Joel can address very well, because he's looked at what's happened with stimulus payments in the past. And effectively what's happened is, of the stimulus payments, about a third gets saved, about a third pays down debt, and a third gets spent. Over time, the portion that pays down debt, paying off credit card bills, gets spent as well. But typically, people who have credit card debt will pay it off with those stimulus payments and not be stimulating the economy. And the wealthy people do put it in the bank and save it for the rainy day.
Joel?
Well, the conventional wisdom used to be that, in fact, because lower-income people would be more likely to spend a bigger share of a tax cut to fight a recession when we want people to spend more should be targeted toward low-income people. Our own research, my own with my colleague Matthew Shapiro here at the University of Michigan, suggests that for the stimulus programs in recent years, that really hasn't turned out to be true. But one has to realize that over the long run, that is when we're not thinking about tax policy as a way to counter a recession, we probably want to encourage savings. We do have this fiscal imbalance looking out a decade, two decades, three decades. So one way to minimize the consequences of that is to get people, the country as a whole, to save more. So although in the short run we want to think about tax cuts to people who will spend it, in the long run we have a different perspective.
Here is an email from Peter in Chesapeake, Virginia, who says, what about the 15% tax paid by hedge fund managers? Why are they paying an investment rate on their earnings rather than the plus 30% I have to pay on my meager wages? David.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a problem. It's this technicality in which essentially the pay of hedge fund managers is treated like an investment gain.
How did that happen?
Well, essentially their pay is often based on the gain in the investment that they have made on behalf of their clients. And so that's the technical reason that it happened. And I agree. I think the argument is quite strong that should be treated like ordinary income and taxed as such. The only caveat I'd add is sometimes this is a little bit exaggerated in terms of how big an effect this has on the tax code. Warren Buffett has said that he pays a lower tax rate than, for example, his secretary.
Right.
And that may or may not be true once you actually take into account the corporate taxes that Buffett effectively pays. But it's not true that the typical very rich person pays a lower tax rate than the typical middle class person. The tax rate on net still is progressive. It's less progressive than it used to be, but it still is progressive.
What about the possibility of a value-added tax, Joel?
A lot of people are talking about introducing a value-added tax for if and when we take seriously this long-term fiscal imbalance. I think there's a good argument for including that if we were going to start taking this seriously. It's a tax used by over 150 countries. The U.S. is the only major country that doesn't have a tax like that. It has. It's not without its problems. The burden of this tax would be regressive, not progressive. So as a fraction of income, the burden would be higher for low-income people than it would be for upper-income people.
But to counteract that, don't upper-income people buy more expensive things?
They do. And so there's no question that the tax burden in dollars would be higher for high-income people because they buy more, but as a fraction of their income. And that's usually how we think of progressivity. That isn't true. And so, sure, like the income tax and other consumption taxes, the burden is higher for higher-income people, but as a fraction of income, it probably isn't higher.
So how likely is it that we're going?
In the short run, I'm not betting on it. One used to hear for decades that we'll address our fiscal imbalance once we have a crisis. I think over the last couple of years, we have to refine that because we know not just any economic crisis will get us to face up to this. Maybe a crisis that is more clearly related to the fiscal imbalance might do it, but I don't see the political logjam breaking in the short term.
Joel Slemrod, he's professor of economics at the University of Michigan. He's co-author of Taxing Ourselves, A Citizen's Guide to the Debate Over Taxes. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning. I just really want to make a quick comment. Well, I am a small business owner. I'm single, so I'm one of those people who are paying a lot in taxes. But I'm so fed up with everybody wanting the wealthy to pay. It's like we have a sense of entitlement. Make the wealthy pay for everything. My whole objective, if I were running this country, I would never tax people who create jobs. I don't mean little businesses like me. I mean the big businesses, because the more money they have, the more jobs they create, which is good all the way around. I think we're on the road to insanity.
David.
The problem with the idea of not taxing people who create jobs is then you're saying that you don't want highways that actually function, and you don't want funding for schools, and you don't want funding for scientific research.
How do you get to that?
If you say we're not going to tax people who create jobs, you're saying we're not going to tax a huge portion of our economy. If you say we're not going to tax a huge portion of our economy, you're saying you want a vastly smaller government. And if you say you want a vastly smaller government, you have to start talking about eliminating very popular programs. You have to talk about drastically shrinking the military. You have to talk about getting rid of Medicare. You have to talk about getting rid of funding for science and for roads. And so I would love to pay less taxes than I do. But the taxes that I pay are used for things. And so we need to reconnect this discussion between taxes and government spending. If we want to have a society with much lower taxes, we need a society that spends much less on Medicare, much less on Social Security, much less on the military, much less on other government programs, or some combination of those things. And we can't continue to do all those things, which are popular, and cut taxes and live in a country that has a serious economic policy.
So, Joel, if you were king of the country at this point, what would be your solution to the tax issue?
If I were king of the country, I would be happy to see the tax rates on high-income people go up for a while, but I would recognize that if we're going to face up to the longer-term fiscal problem, the tax revenues can't come only from high-income people. I think David stated the problem just right. First, we have to decide what we want government to do. Then we have to tax ourselves in a fair way to get that money. And our discussion today has pointed out there's two kinds of fairness going on here. One is fairness across people at different income levels, and second, fairness across generations, because the different ways to deal with our long-term fiscal imbalance can have very different effects depending on your age.
Bob?
I actually like the idea of a VAT, because a broad-based low-rate VAT would draw in a lot of money, help balance things. If you're concerned about the regressivity of the VAT, which many of us are, you can reverse that fairly readily just by providing subsidies at the bottom end of the distribution to help pay a basic subsistence portion of the VAT. But David and Joel are both absolutely right. You got to pay for what you want. And if you want the government services, you need the taxes.
I do think it's important to add that we cannot solve this problem simply by taxing the wealthy. And in some ways, the Obama administration has suggested through its words that that is the case, and it's not. Taxes can't go up only on high-income households in order to close this deficit. They have to go up on nearly everyone, or we have to drastically cut spending.
David Leonhard, he's a columnist for The New York Times. Robertson Williams, he's Principal Research Associate at the Tax Policy Center, and Joel Slemrod, Professor of Economics at the University of Michigan, author of Taxing Ourselves. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.